Well, I sent Mo a PowerPoint last night, and it's somewhere out there in cyberspace, he said, because it didn't make it to his house. So, fortunately, it's nothing that I was going to be relying on this morning. But, you know, you always kind of get used to doing things, and then you think something's missing. You don't have PowerPoint. So we won't be using that this morning. But what I want to talk to you about is really about us being strangers and pilgrims this morning. And that's a concept that if you only think in terms of today and what we think about when we think of a pilgrim, you may have the wrong idea. I mean, when I think pilgrim, and especially when it's close to Thanksgiving, I think of guys dressed in funny black suits eating turkey. And that was really the idea in the Bible when God mentioned pilgrims at all. But the word pilgrim really was somebody who lived in another country that was not his own. It was somebody who was like a foreigner in a place that he was kind of displaced. He was an alien or a stranger, and he was living in a place that really didn't belong to him. And we are called just that. The Bible describes us, those who are Christians, as strangers and pilgrims in 1 Peter chapter 2, and in the passage that was just read a minute ago, in chapter 2 and verse 11, he said, "I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from the fleshly lusts which wage against the soul." And then when he started his letter, the first verse of the first chapter, it said, "Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia." Resident aliens, those who reside as aliens. So I want to talk to you about that for just a minute, the idea of us being strangers and pilgrims. I think it's a very hard thing to do. Wouldn't be surprised if everybody in here knows that concept and can acknowledge, yep, I know that, I've seen that in the Bible. But to live it every day, I think is a very challenging thing for us to do. And this idea is not something that was just exclusive to the New Testament. It was something that I found God's people have always been recognized and believed about themselves, that they were resident aliens, strangers who live in this world, but believe themselves to be citizens of another country. And I want to start with us going back to the book of Genesis in chapter 23 and notice Abraham. Let's go back to the book of Genesis, chapter 23. You remember Abraham, who was the father of the nation of Israel. And he moved to Canaan from the Ur of the Chaldees. And he lived in Canaan for a number of years. And in chapter 23, his wife has died. Sarah had died. And she is 127 years old. That would make Abraham about 137, wouldn't it? Because he was 10 years older than his wife. And he needs a place to bury her. Now, that wouldn't be really big. That's ordinarily not a problem. But Abraham had left his land, and he moved his family to a place where he owned no property. And he has been a resident of Canaan for about 67 years. If he arrived when he was 75, and now his wife is 127, if you calculate that all out, he's been there about 167, about 67 years. And he still doesn't own any property. Most of us here will own property in our life, someplace that we can call our own. But he never owned any property. And he has to negotiate for a spot to bury his wife. And so in Genesis chapter 23 and then in verse 3 and 4, Abraham arose from before his dead, and he spoke to the sons of Heth, so some of the local residents living in Canaan. And he said, "I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." I think that's a pretty important moment in Abraham's life, because he's an old man now, and he's looking toward the end of his life, his wife is dead, and yet he has to reckon with the fact that he owns nothing. God made him a promise to give him that land, and he has not received a square inch of that property. And he's been there for 67 years. And so he says to these people, I am a stranger and a sojourner. He recognizes he is just a sojourner in that land. Not him. Doesn't belong to him. And I need a place to bury my wife. But not only did Abraham contemplate that and have to wrestle with that, but also his grandson, Jacob. I'm sure Isaac did too, but look, if you went down, I thought about Jacob. Look at him. Look in chapter 47. Genesis chapter 47. I appreciate you young people who are looking in your Bibles and following along with us when we study. It's good for you to catch me in some errors when I misread things. You can point those out. Genesis chapter 47. Now it says in verse 8 that he's having a conversation. Jacob's having a conversation with Pharaoh. He's had a long life. Jacob's moved down to Egypt because Joseph's there, and he's invited his father and family down there. He's having a conversation with the Pharaoh of Egypt. That'd be pretty impressive. And the Pharaoh says, how old are you? How many years have you lived? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my, look at verse 9, sojourning are 130 years. So he's just about the same age as Abraham when Sarah died. Not quite. Abraham probably was 137, but he's 130 years old. And so now he appears before Pharaoh, and you see the same words. The years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained to the years that my fathers lived during their days of sojourning. I mean, when you use the word sojourning, what you're saying is, I don't really belong here. I'm a stranger, I'm an alien, I just tented, I just camped, I just lived as an alien in this land. And interestingly, he had to do it for 130 years. You know, Abraham only had lived 67 years with no property. But Jacob's lived the entirety of his life. He's never known a place that he owned. So 130 years, a stranger in the land. No settled place, no place to call home. Now, there's a couple examples of people who understood the idea of living in a land that was not their own, never felt like it was their own, and understood they were strangers. But there are also some people who came to accept that land as being theirs. There are those who, I guess it by contrast, those in that same family who found themselves, for themselves, a home in the land. Think about Esau. Think about Esau, the brother of Jacob. Look back to chapter 26. Genesis chapter 26. We're told that Esau, who was Jacob's brother, married some of the daughters of the land, and he brought grief to his parents. Chapter 26, verse 34 and 35. Or 33 and 34. No, sorry, 34 and 35. It said, when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judah, the daughter of Beri, the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Esau never does get a very good... it never has a page devoted to him that's very, very encouraging in the Bible. In fact, in Hebrews chapter 12, he's noted and called a profane man. He's called a profane. That doesn't mean he used profanity, I don't think. When somebody says profane, we think that must mean they use bad language. It just means he was an earthly man. He was a man who was attached to the things of this world. I mean, and we know his story. When he was about to die of hunger, he sells off his birthright in exchange for a pot of stew or a cup of porridge or whatever Jacob had there that he was negotiating with him on. But it was more significant than just that he was trying to survive. He traded in his spiritual blessings. There were blessings attached to that birthright, spiritual blessings that he was offered. And so he was, you know, he shows in different ways that he was very much at home in this world. We're told, again, that he didn't feel the need to marry into the family, the promised people there. I mean, he is an earthly fellow. Esau was. And there's another man that we might mention. His name is Lot. And you remember Lot. If you go back to Genesis 13, Abraham and Lot traveled together to the land of Canaan. Lot was the nephew of Abraham. And God blessed them with a lot of things, a lot of possessions. In verse 6, it said they had so many flocks and herds that the land couldn't sustain them, for their possessions were so great they couldn't remain together. So Abraham, being the man he is, he said, listen, here's all the land before you. You choose which way you want to go. You go the direction you want to go. I will take the other direction. And you settle where you want to settle. So Lot looks about him, looks down over all the plains and all the land. And it says that as he looked down, he said in verse 10, he lifted up his eyes and he saw all the valley of the Jordan. It was well watered. And before the Lord, he said, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, this area was like the garden of the Lord. So it must have been very beautiful. And it was like the land of Egypt, as far as you go to Zoar. Probably Lot would have remembered that. Lot had been to Egypt. So he would have seen that, and it would have compared to the land of Egypt where he had been. And so Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan. It said Abraham settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled, and look at verse 12. It says, Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Those were cities that were well known for their wickedness. This was not some kind of mistake. Lot was just ignorant. Those cities were well known for their nature. But it was a place that he moved to, and he calls, you know, that becomes his home. I'm not saying that he participated in the wickedness. Lot's called a righteous man, 2 Peter. And it said that it vexed his spirit every day as he saw the wickedness going on around him. But I think the point of the Bible writer to put that there is for us to see the contrast in Lot and Abraham. Abraham always stays out on the fringes. He is a nomad. He is a sojourner. He is a pilgrim. He lived in tents. He stayed away. But Lot moves into the cities. He finds himself a home. And he sort of becomes comfortable in it. Even though I say he didn't participate in wickedness, when the angel comes to get him out before he destroys Sodom, what does he have to do? He has to grab them by the hands and takes them out because they resist it. And so, you know, it's an interesting contrast that Lot seems to find himself a home and settles down and has property, but Abraham never does. He is always this pilgrim, this sojourner out on the fringes. Well, let's go back to the positive case again. Another person that we may not think about, kind of an interesting case, David. Look over to Psalm 39. Remember David, the king, second king of Israel. If you look in Psalm 39, I found this was interesting. Psalm 39 and verse 12. This is in a prayer that David's offering in this psalm to the Lord. He says, hear my prayer, O Lord, give ear to my cry, do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee, a sojourner like all my fathers. Interesting, he uses that same language to describe himself. And then let's look at one other passage and then make a couple of observations about that. Look back to 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles, one of those books we don't look at very often. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 14 through 16. Also recorded the lives of many of the kings of Israel and Judah. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 14 through 16. David is nearing the end of his life, and he is compiling the materials to build the temple. There's no temple yet. There's still the tabernacle. But he's getting things together because his son Solomon's going to build that temple later. But look at the language here. I've always read this because I like the prayer. I think it's an incredible prayer. But think about it as in the context of what we're studying this morning. In verse 13, he says, "Therefore, our God, we thank thee, we praise thy glorious name." Verse 14, "But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer as generously as this? For all things come from thee, and from thy hand we have given thee." So he says, nothing that we're offering you is something that was ours to begin with. Didn't belong to us, wasn't our property. It was yours to begin with. You've just given it to us, and we're just sort of giving it back. Okay? And then, look a little bit further. Look at verse 15. "For we are sojourners." There's that word that we were talking about this morning. "We are sojourners before thee, and tenants, as all our fathers were. For our days on earth are like a shadow, and there is no hope." I think that's interesting. He says, we don't own anything. We're just giving back to you what you gave to us to begin with. We're like tenants. It's almost like somebody that moves in. You know, you ever been a tenant? Where you move into an apartment and everything's fully furnished. It was all just kind of given to you. But it really isn't yours, is it? You just live on somebody else's property temporarily. And he says, we're just tenants living on borrowed property. I think this is interesting that David, because, you know, if we think about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, well, sure, they were sojourners. Sure, they were like nomads because they didn't own it. They arrived in Canaan, lived there for a while, and they hadn't conquered the land. But this isn't in the time of Abraham. This is hundreds of years later, right? So Israel's been living in the land for hundreds of years, and they've owned the land. It's their land. They've had the possession. But David here says, no, we're just sojourners. We don't really belong. We're living on borrowed land, just like our fathers. I think that speaks really well of David, that he could be a king who certainly would have property and a place to live, but he recognizes that still he is a sojourner in the land. Very different setting than with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but he still has that same mentality. And I think he teaches us, I mean, it teaches me that there is not anywhere in this world that really is our promised land. I think he came to understand what Abraham understood. And that's helpful to me. Let's look over to Hebrews 11. This is a passage that we probably come to our minds first when we think about this. Hebrews chapter 11. But it's helpful to me because none of us here live in a tent, I don't think. I think all of us probably have property. Now, the bank may own the property, but we still live in a place. And that I can still understand and have this concept of being a sojourner and a pilgrim is helpful when you see David, who had and maintained that idea. Hebrews chapter 11, beginning in verse 8 and 9, says, "By faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going." And verse 9 says, "By faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, and as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise." Here they are, they're strangers on earth, the land doesn't belong to them, wasn't really theirs. You know, God was taking them there, but he had took them there, but he was really taking them somewhere else. That was not really their final dwelling place, and they seem to realize that. Look down a little bit further in verse 13. "All these died in faith," talking about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, their families. And he says, "without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth." Well, those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they had went out, like that is the Ur of the Chaldees, then they would have had the opportunity to return. I think that's good. I mean, if Abraham was just looking for something here, well, he could have gone back to where he lived to begin with. If he never could quite grasp, get a hold, or some piece of property in Canaan, he could have always went back home. There are a lot of opportunities for Abraham to settle. But it says indeed, it says in verse 16, "But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God's not ashamed to be called their God, for he was preparing a city for them." So they're looking, even when they're in the land, even when they possess the land, they look beyond it to something greater. David says, no matter how much of this turf, no matter how much of this soil you own, It's really, none of it really belongs to us. You really don't own it. Not really. I found a couple other examples interesting and instructive. I have to hurry so I don't run out of time. Moses, whenever God wanted to prepare somebody to do something very difficult, a lot of times he would take them out of their home, take them away from their home. Moses grew up in Egypt 40 years, lived in the residences of the Pharaoh, palaces. But when God wanted to prepare him to do the work he had for him to deliver Israel, what did he do? He took him out and he sent him to Midian. And he lived as a shepherd and as a nomad in tents for about 40 years before he was able to come back, and God had prepared him to rescue the children of Israel. So he was a sojourner and an alien, and he understood what that meant to be a foreigner in the world. Jacob, God, when he needed to discipline him, sent him back to Laban in Haran. Remember that. He sent him out of Canaan back to Haran to live with Laban. And he spent time there, maybe 14 years at least, as he worked for Rachel and Leah, and worked as a shepherd. And so it's interesting, whenever God really wanted to prepare somebody for a task, he sent them out of their land to become an alien in another land. Interesting. It is so easy for us to get attached to things in this world, isn't it? It's so easy for us to get attached to our blessings and the things we have. Don't they become our security, even when we don't want them to? Don't we really put a lot of trust and find security sometime in the blessings that we receive? And God knows that happens. God knows that's a possibility. Doesn't make those things evil that we have. It just means that there's a risk that we'll forget and put our confidence in the blessings rather than the giver of the blessings. Remember, God warned Israel of that, Deuteronomy chapter 8 in verse 11. He said, "Beware lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and ordinances and his statutes, lest when you've eaten and are satisfied, you built good houses, you lived in them, when your herds and flocks multiply, your silver and your gold, all that you have multiply, then your heart becomes proud and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and the house of slavery. You were nothing. You had nothing. You were wanderers in the wilderness, and I brought you in here. Just everything was furnished, fully furnished." He said, be careful you don't forget God when you have these things, because it's so easy. One other verse here in the Old Testament, and then we'll go to the New Testament. Look in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 23. Leviticus 25, 23. God, in his law, he made some ordinances and put some things in there, I think, to help Israel avoid this temptation to put too much, to become at home in their land, to think that they really owned it and it was their real possession. In chapter 25 of Leviticus, in verse 23, he says here, "The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are but aliens and sojourners with me." And he goes on and he makes some stipulations about this. They may have had a piece of property. It was the inheritance was divided among the families. People had a place to live, but they really couldn't sell it. Couldn't sell the property. I mean, we know there was the year of Jubilee, when all of, if you rented your property out or somebody else was living on your property or whatever, or you had to sell it for some reason, at Jubilee, it all came back. All came back to you. Because it really wasn't theirs to sell. It really wasn't their property to sell. He said, it belongs to me. They were just sojourners and tenants on God's land. And otherwise, they might have thought that it really did belong to them. They could sell it. But it really wasn't their home. They were aliens and sojourners. Well, look in the New Testament, because we find the same emphasis there. We'll make a couple of observations here, and then we'll make some applications. Luke chapter 9, we find the same emphasis, and it applied to Jesus. Luke chapter 9, verse 57 and 58. Remember, people were following Jesus, and they were making statements like, "I'll follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said, well, he said in verse 58, "The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." I don't think Jesus was saying that he was too poor to ever build a house. I don't think it was that he just impossible for him to ever have done it. But it, there's no indication that he ever really had a place of his own. And that fits, doesn't it, with what he came to do. Fits with what he came to do. And then look over in John chapter 1 and verse 14. John chapter 1 and verse 14. You know, John begins saying that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he makes the application the Word was Christ. And then verse 14, he says the Word became flesh, and he dwelt among us. And if your Bible has a little footnote where it uses the word dwelt there, you'll find that the word tabernacle is there, the verb tabernacle. And a tabernacle is obviously a tent, or a temporary dwelling. And we understand, you know, that Jesus said, I came to tabernacle among you. I was planning to stay here. It's not a permanent place for me, but I tabernacled among you. And we say, well, I understand that. His home was heaven, and he was just here for a short time. But I think the point is that, you know, those who are the children of God, the truly God's people, that our citizenship is in heaven. And really, this earth is not permanent, and we are just tabernacling here. We're just camping. You know, we sing the song about Canaan, the real, you know, that Canaan, to Canaan's land I'm on my way. The real place that belongs to us is heaven itself. And we're supposed to be like Jesus. We're supposed to be just tabernacling here, just camping, temporary dwelling here. And so our desire should be a different home. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 6 and 8. Just make some practical applications here. What does it mean to say that we're strangers and pilgrims here? Look, if you would, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. I would suggest, first of all, that our bodies are just temporary shelters. They were given to us to remind us that this is really not our permanent dwelling. From 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 1, we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God. A house not made with hands that's eternal in the heavens. There's the contrast. We live in it. Well, why does he call our body a tent? Well, just pull it. You know, you have a tent and pull one cord and the whole thing collapses. It's just fragile. It's not permanent. It's not. It's temporary. It's mobile. It's portable. The Lord gave us a tent to camp out here for a little while. But he didn't make us a building. Didn't reinforce us with steel. We're fragile, but our real bodies, our eternal, immortal bodies, are in another place. They're waiting for us there. And so, verse 6 and 7 says, this is how we ought to think. Therefore, being always of good courage, this is verse 6 of chapter 5, and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not sight. We are of good courage, though, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be home with the Lord. We should want to be out of this body and in another place with the Lord. That should be our desire. And the way our bodies are, they remind us that we are just tabernacling here temporarily. Maybe that's a better way. Maybe that's a positive way to look at our bodies whenever they're breaking down and they're fragile and it hurts when you get up in the morning and we grumble about it and complain about it. Maybe if there's some kind of bright light in all of that, we can see the purpose of that they are to be a reminder that we are just temporarily here, that we are going somewhere to get an immortal body, an eternal body. And if somehow that concept can fill us up, it might help us so that there's a positive side of the pains that we go through. There's another thing that's going to happen too. What does it mean to say we're strangers and pilgrims? It means that we won't engage in the common effort to make our temporary blessings produce some kind of eternal joy, some kind of lasting joy and fulfillment. That's what Solomon did for a while in his life. He made that mistake, Ecclesiastes chapter 2. He lost sight of God. And you decide that when you don't have God in your life, what you have to do is you have to try to find some, make something visible in this life, produce lasting joy. Because really, the only real joy is in heaven. But Solomon spent a lot of effort, a lot of time in his life, energy, money, trying to make this life produce something that it was never designed to produce. And so he said in verse 3 of Ecclesiastes 2, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely. Verse 4, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted them all the kind of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate the forest. I bought male and female slaves. I had homeborn slaves. I possessed flocks and herds. I collected silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers. He just lists this, all of this list of things that he went did, and it was all designed to somehow give him a sense of fulfillment. And at the end of all that list, he says, I considered, verse 11, all the activities of my hands, all that they had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, it was all vanity, striving after the wind. There's no lasting value in it. It's a waste of my time, waste of my energy. And people spend their whole lives looking for things that will make them happy here. But it's kind of like a drug, isn't it? It does temporarily, but then after you build up resistance to it, you have to up the dosage. You have to keep buying more of it, and you have to increase the dosage to keep feeling good. And that's what people do. But if we're just pilgrims, if we have that concept and we accept up front that it is not going to produce lasting joy, it will not make me happy. Maybe if we will live like that with that concept, we won't spend so much energy building and compiling and trying to accumulate things to accomplish something that they were never designed to do. There's another thing, too, that's going to happen when I ask the question, what does it mean to say we're strangers and pilgrims? Is that we're going to be doing things that won't make sense to people around us. We're going to do things that will not make sense to other people around us. 1 Peter chapter 4, you can turn over there, we'll read a verse or two there. Probably most of us, or some of us, probably have neighbors or people at work that are foreigners. And sometimes foreigners do things that are kind of silly, some things that don't make any sense to you. You say, why does he do that? What do they have that silly practice for? It's kind of a ritual. I can't relate to that. Well, guess what? If you move to another country, those people think the same thing about you because we have habits too. And we do silly things. They'll say, what in the world does he do that kind of thing for? Because we have ways that we live in our culture that's different than other places. And Christians will do things that this world just doesn't think make sense if we really are foreigners and strangers. And we won't fit. 1 Peter 4, he says, and of course, this is the same letter where Peter is addressing these people as foreigners and strangers and aliens. He says, therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. For the time has already passed. The time already passed is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued the course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousals, drinking parties, abominable idolatries. And in all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them in the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. He says, the time has already passed for you to live like Gentiles. Now you've given that up and you live differently. And when they look at you, they're going to mock you. They're going to say, what is wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Why don't you live like the rest of us? Why are you so different? Why are you so odd? You know, you shouldn't be too surprised if we are strangers and we are aliens and we are pilgrims in this land. And if the worst thing that ever happens is people mock us, that's not near as bad as it could get. And it did get much worse for Christians in the first century. And we know the passage in Hebrews 11, at the end of that chapter of faith, where he talks about people who were pilgrims and strangers. And he says, Hebrews chapter 11, and verse 35, He said, women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured and not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, and they were sawn in two, and they were tempted, and they were put to death with the sword. And they went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. Here are some pilgrims, and they just didn't fit in. They were never accepted, and it says that they were rejected by society. They were cast out by society. But strangers. We use the words like backwoods. He's backwoods. He's old school and things like that. So, well, when you don't fit in, you might expect that. It shouldn't be too surprising if people say that about us. And I always wrestle, how hard do I try to fit in? How hard do I try to fit in? I'm not saying we should be deliberate oddballs and try to be the neighborhood cranks. That's not what I'm saying. But if we lead godly lives, inevitably people will notice it, and we will not fit in. But if we try to live life trying to fit in and be comfortable and not rock the boat, then if that becomes the standard by which we measure everything, we may fit in, but we will have become part of this world. It will inevitably suggest that we have really made this world our home. Well, we're out of time. I have other things. So I'll try to cut this short. We'll have to walk by faith and not by sight. We'll have opportunities to settle down, just like Abraham did, but we're going to have to turn some opportunities down if we're going to live by faith. We can't let ourselves get too tied down to this world. I'm not trying to teach a new doctrine here. But you know, in the Old Testament, the patriarchs didn't want their children to take a wife from among the daughters of the land. You know, they wanted them to stay within the family. Don't get too tied to this world. If you know, there are risks when we tie ourselves to worldly things. It's hard to break away from. Don't invest yourself here. Jesus said, "Don't lay up treasures on earth, but lay up treasures in heaven." Be so seductive. So seductive. You'd ask Monica, I can't hardly wait to get down and clean my basement out and try to make it more move things around so I can put my car in it sometime. And I can feel so fulfilled when I get everything cleaned out and all is organized and all is perfect and all that. And sometimes I shake my head and it's embarrassing. And I think about how easy it is to make things my primary focus in this world. Primary focus. And I ask, what would Abraham say to us? What would David say if he walked by and he saw us? Would they shake their head at us? Say, those aren't pilgrims, those aren't strangers? Or would they recognize us too? Would they recognize us as pilgrims and strangers and sojourners in this world? There may have been one brief moment in history when man was not a pilgrim on the earth. I think in the Garden of Eden. I think God made that to be the home for Adam. He wasn't a pilgrim. He wasn't a stranger or an alien when he was there. But it was sin that caused him to be driven from that home that God had prepared for him. And sin resulted in the ground producing thistles and briars and thorns that spread to the whole world. Now the whole world is destined for destruction, 2 Peter 3 says. Well, as sinners, we have to live in this world, and we kind of fit in as sinners. But as godly men, we should not fit in. We should not fit into this world as godly men. And so the invitation this morning is to place your citizenship in heaven. We need to declare this world to no longer be our home. We've had time, Peter said, we've had ample time to live in this world in the lust of our flesh, but it's time to devote our rest of our life toward the home that God prepared for us. If there's someone here this morning that needs to declare this world is not going to be his home, that he's going to set his sights on the city whose foundations and builder is God, that you're going to begin your journey today as we stand and sing our song, believing in Jesus.